You are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Ben Nelson.
I'm Violet Miles.
I'm Armand Rana.
I'm Isa Yu.
I'm Zachary Tharp.
I'm Alex Trabulsi.
I'm Gurmon Gill.
It's Thursday, October 10th at 5.05 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
On today's show, we'll be focusing on the recent allegations of misconduct faced by UBC Greek Life. But to start today's show off, we have some profiles of ridings in Vancouver for the upcoming federal elections.
Thanks, Violet. As you can see, we have a full house today. So in the Vancouver Quadra riding, which is this riding here in UBC, the incumbent Liberal MP is Joyce Murray. She won in 2015 in a landslide, securing 59% of the vote. Her nearest competitor that year was Conservative candidate Blair Lockhart, who secured 26% of the vote that year. In that election, the NDP candidate Scott Andrews obtained 11%, while the Green candidate Chris Constable received only 4% of the vote. Given that this is considered one of the most secure Liberal seats in the country, having been held by Liberals for 35 years, there hasn't been much recent polling available about this riding. You can probably check it out on 338.com, which has like a 99% chance of a Liberal victory. Given that this is, and the riding includes UBC, as I mentioned, and western portions of the suburban west side in Vancouver, including some of the wealthier households in Vancouver. The incumbent Joyce Murray succeeded Jane Philpott as president of the Treasury Board. She's had a long career both in provincial and federal politics as well as in business. There's a great interview in the Taai by Michael Harris called Joyce Murray's Toughing It Out, if listeners want to learn more about her positions. The other candidates are conservative Kathleen Dixon, an investment banking executive, geologist, and mineral exploration entrepreneur. Then there's NDP Leigh Kenny, a veteran of the Canadian Armed Forces. The Green Party's Jeff Wright, an engineer, researcher, and professor. People's Party Sandra Filosof Schipper, a private and business owner. And so one of the issues that I sense is going to be important to residents in this riding, as someone who lives and talks to other residents in this riding, is tackling climate change and preserving the environment. Joyce Murray has historically emphasized dealing with climate change. For example, she opposed the Trans Mountain pipeline, but her government recently bought that pipeline. So it'll be interesting to see what voters make of her and make of her positions on the environment, especially with the Green Party rising in the polls nationally and the NDP emphasizing climate action a lot in their recent campaign material. And now moving from a super safe riding to one that is being somewhat more actively contested, Gurmon has a breakdown on the Vancouver South riding.
All right. Thanks, Armand. I wanted to do a bit of a breakdown of Vancouver South. Vancouver South is one of the more ethnically diverse ridings in the city. There are about 100,000 people in there, and just over one-third of them are Chinese, about one-fifth Caucasian, about one-fifth South Asian. The riding starts from 41st Avenue in the north, and it goes all the way down to the Fraser River, to the southern border of the city. From east to west, it runs from Boundary Road to Cambie. Vancouver South is currently held by the Liberals, and their current MP is Harjit Sajjan, who is also Canada's current defense minister. And running against Sajjan is the NDP's Sean McKillen, the Green Party's Judy Zaikowski, and Elaine Dieng of the PPC. And throughout the riding's history, Vancouver South has been heavily fought over by the Liberal and Conservative Party, and only those two parties have ever run this riding. Conservative Wei Young held the Vancouver South riding in 2011, but she lost to Sejan in 2015. And after losing her riding, Wei Young then ran for mayor of Vancouver, and she also lost that too. She'll be running again in Vancouver South and will be hoping to win her riding back. But according to 338canada.com, the Liberal Party has approximately a 9-point lead and 91% chance of winning the riding.
Cool. Thanks, guys. We have a couple of local headlines to share as well.
Sorry, there's so many people in studio. So the first headline is about the Vancouver Parks Board and Recreation. So they recently endorsed final two reports on van play, Van Play is the city's Parks and Recreation master plan, like their strategy. So Van Play will guide the board as they continue to plan and grow parks and recreation in Vancouver. The Van Play strategy will have sweeping implications, according to the park board, for much of the board's day-to-day operations, as well as its parks and faculty planning. So the Van Play strategy relies on three bold moves: equity, needs assessment, and connectivity. So that means the park board will take stock of its assets. Then they'll work to address imbalances in the delivery of those assets, those resources, and work to create healthy communities by encouraging the connection and integration of parks and facilities with existing neighborhoods and neighborhood cultures within the city and more broadly the region. So now for another Alex on the News Collective.
Thanks, Alex. So developer Westbank, one word, property owner Crombie RIET, and architectural firm Perkins and Will filed a rezoning application for 1087 West Broadway. This is for a mixed-use development featuring three residential towers and 2427 30 stories. It would include over 500 condos and 160 rental units. People from the neighborhood are concerned about the increased density and lack of green space. Others voice concerns over the sporadic nature of the density and the lack of graduation between one- to two-story buildings and high-rises. Residents in favor of the project argue that the project does not go far enough in adding homes to the neighborhood. And now for a sports headline from our resident sports expert, Ben Nelson.
Thanks, Alex. So this past weekend, the Vancouver Female Ice Hockey Association hosted one of their annual Come Try Hockey events. It was aimed at young female players 4 and up to come and try hockey for their very first time. Kids participated in drills and passing exercises, among other events. It took place at the Killarney Ice Rink and was a real community affair. Each player got their own on-ice volunteer to help them if they needed it, and the equipment that the players used was completely from donors. All players needed to do to play was have a form filled out, and then they were able to borrow hockey equipment. Hockey is one of the more costly sports for kids in Canada, so the event provided a great opportunity for them to play at no cost. The goal of the event is to get young girls playing hockey and to expand the Vancouver Female Ice Hockey Association. It is reported by the Vancouver Sun that 30% of the players who go to the Come Try Hockey events join the league. The next event will take place in March. Come Try Hockey was held on the World Girls' Ice Hockey Weekend, presented by the International Ice Hockey Federation. The weekend is aimed at growing the women's game in Canada, with hockey fanatics uniting to celebrate the game they love. Getting more female athletes interested in hockey is very important right now, as the Canadian Women's Hockey League was forced to fold this past May. This occurred even though the finals match set a new Canadian Women's Hockey League record for viewership and the league having multiple Olympians participate. Despite this unfortunate turn of events, there is still hope. Because of events like the one in Killarney, female hockey in Canada has risen from around 86,000 skaters in 2014-2015 to around 88,000 now. Hopefully more interest will spark the Canadian Women's Hockey League to be able to open their rinks once again.
Cool. Thank you, Ben. Now for our first feature, myself, Violet Miles, with help from Zachary Tharp, did some reporting on the current allegations that six UBC students were drugged at a UBC fraternity event last week. If you remember, we did a brief headline on it at our last show, and we now have a bit more of an extended story on it. So let's take a listen. Following up on the headline we covered last week, UBC fraternities are currently under investigation by the RCMP following recent allegations of misconduct. On October 1st, UBC professor Dr. Marina Adshade tweeted alleging that six women were in Vancouver General Hospital after being drugged at a UBC fraternity event. Adshade brought into question whether Greek life or fraternities and sororities should continue to exist at UBC. My name is Violet Miles, and this past Wednesday, October 9th, I asked UBC students to share their thoughts on these allegations and Greek life in general. Yeah, so there were allegations. There's an investigation underway right now about six women allegedly being roofied at the fraternities. what was your reaction to hearing that news?
Yeah, I don't know. If the allegations are true, I just think it's absolutely ridiculous. I have five sisters, so to know that they can't have the same privileges that I do to go to a party and feel safe and, like, they're just going there for a good time. I don't think anyone goes to a party looking to get roofied. And no, seriously, I don't think anyone goes to a party looking to get roofied. And the fact that you have to use drugs to sleep with people is really says a lot about your character. And if that actually happened, I think the people that did it should really look at themselves and, well, I mean, they should be punished if they're figured out. But if they aren't ever, it's never figured out who did it, should really do a lot of introspection of why they're doing what they're doing, because it's ridiculous.
I'm, like, kind of speechless, because what kind of ethics have been, like, you know, to get into a frat, like, you have to show, like, a certain set of qualities, and I think that just those actions kind of display that those set of, like, individuals do not possess that, and I'm kind of, like, disgusted.
I was really surprised and also scared for, you know, people that I knew or anyone, and I hope everyone's okay, and there's still a lot of, like, unclear things that happen, so I'm just waiting for more evidence. Yeah,
absolutely. Obviously, there's still just allegations now. Do you guys have any opinion on the role that Greek life plays at UBC, whether or not it has value, and kind of the purpose that it serves in our communities?
I think there's value in the sense that it does bring people together as a community, especially if you are super ostracized and you're needing, like, a group of people to help you get through university, because obviously, like, your first year too, it's super hard to adapt here, I feel like, and just in general, because who doesn't debate their life while they're here? But I also think that if you have to pay, like, $40,000 just to get into a community, I'm questioning, like, why you feel like those people are the best people to surround yourself with. Obviously, that's just a generalization, but I don't know. I also just think that I would be so down if we just got rid of Greek life culture altogether, because I feel like it's so problematic at the end of the day with just, like...
Yeah, I know, think I right Greek life has the potential to make community, but as Aiden was saying, I think, like, your community is based on privilege, because you have to have the privilege to even spend the money and spend time partying rather than doing other things. So I think it's just helping, like, perpetuate a classist kind of university experience where the people who have the privilege and the ability to go and spend their time doing these things are the ones who end up getting that community. I don't know if Greek life is university funded, but if it is funded by the university, I don't really know why they would fund that and not other possibly better community building avenues. But I do know that Greek life also gets a lot of donor funding, so yeah. And I know that there's, like, there's a culture, almost a cancel culture in Greek life of, if you're no longer in Greek life, you kind of get almost disowned. So it seems like a way to kind of get you into this vicious cycle of paying people to, like, keep your community. So
I don't know a lot about, like, Greek life. I don't have personal experience, like, being in it or anything. I think when you live on campus, I guess in terms of, like, student life, like, outside of school and stuff like that, like, especially in first year, I think it plays, like, a pretty big role in just, like, you know, going to parties and stuff like that. Like, I think they're the most accessible student life kind of activities outside of clubs and stuff that people living on campus can, like, do.
Overall, there were a mix of reactions from the students I spoke to. Many expressed disappointment, but still saw value in the Greek community. Myself and my colleague Zach Tharp from CITR News tried to get comment from numerous members of UBC Greek Life about the recent allegations of roofying. We reached out to over 30 fraternity and sorority members. Some didn't reply, most who did declined, although we were able to get two statements from individuals with connections to UBC Greek Life. The first statement I'm going to read is from a student who alleges she was roofied at a fraternity party on campus last year. Almost a year ago, in maybe November or December 2018, a fraternity held an event which my friends and I attended. My friends and I were drinking before as a pregame and drank the normal amount that we always do. Therefore, we are as drunk as we were used to. We are all experienced drinkers, and the night definitely hadn't gotten to heavy drinking yet. We were having fun, socializing, and felt we wanted more alcohol to drink. We asked around and were brought downstairs to an empty room where they gave us some pre-poured drinks. The amount in each cup looked like more than a shot, but still very little relative to a whole cup. It was a weird pink color and smelt like nothing familiar. I had a decent-sized sip, drinking about half of it. I thought it tasted gross and put it down. This is where my night took a turn. I went outside to socialize with some friends that we met there, while one of my friends who had drank with me went off elsewhere. I smoked a bit, and after that I felt extremely off and nauseous and decided I wanted to go home. So I told one of my friends and left, as I felt completely capable of walking back to the dorms alone. I didn't even feel out of it. I definitely wasn't that drunk. I ended up hailing a cab and going home. This is where I started having small memory blackouts. I don't remember my car ride home, only paying on a machine, so I assume it was a cab. And then remember being in my room and needing out of nowhere to vomit. I had very little regard for others. I ran out to vomit in the dorm communal bathroom in my underwear and sweater, even though there were people outside. Eventually, I woke up the next morning, having no memory of where I put my belongings and having never felt a stranger hangover. After convening with my friends the next day, we talked about what happened after I left and realized we had all had identical symptoms of small blackouts, but feeling totally fine, and then out of nowhere, so sick and out of it. A year later today, we still talk about this with other girls, and they bring up how their night went similarly at the same event. If these allegations are true, it reveals a disturbing pattern taking place behind the walls of these frat houses. A current UBC sorority member spoke with me about the recent drugging allegations on condition of anonymity. She gave me some insight on how the UBC Greek community has been dealing with the recent events. This individual told me she was shocked to hear of the allegations. If the RCMP investigation finds these allegations to be true, she expects the Greek community to respond swiftly. She told me this kind of behavior is not welcome or tolerated in the community. Both frats and sororities receive annual training from SASC on sexual assault prevention. They also do workshops on harm reduction. She wants our audience to know that herself and her sisters take this matter very seriously and fully support survivors. She defends Greek life, asserting that her chapter is a place where she feels loved and welcomed, and that Greek life is a part of UBC that continues to help students find a sense of belonging and acceptance. I will continue to follow this story closely, and I look forward to hearing the Interfraternity Council's public statement. At the time of publication of this story, the AMS is currently reviewing their relationship with the frats, and the RCMP investigation is still underway. Thank you for listening. Reporting and production by Violet Miles. Reporting assistance by Zachary Tharp. Editing by Alex DeBoer. The song you heard is Focus by A.A. Alto.
Thanks for sharing that story, Violet. It's unfortunate to hear about these allegations, and I hope the people involved will get the justice that they deserve. As you just mentioned, over a week ago, Dr. Adshade's tweet that seemed to be a catalyst for this movement in questioning the benefits of the Greek system was posted. A friend of mine, Alex Nguyen, reported on these events for the campus newspaper, the UBC.
Right, and in Alex's article, she discusses how the AMS, or the Alma Mater Society, just reviewed the relationship that it has with the fraternities on campus, and that just happened last night.
Right. The reason behind this is that AMS gives insurance and legal protections to fraternities using student fees. If the motion brought up yesterday about the relationship is approved, then AMS will have to submit a final review by their November 6th meeting. For now, the university itself is reviewing its relationship with the fraternities. However, the question that still remains are fraternities more liable than an asset? I guess we'll find out.
Yeah, so it was really interesting doing this piece, and I think what I found the most interesting but also kind of disturbing was I reached out to so many members of the UBC Greek Life community, and I know you reached out to some as well, and the ones that did answer, as I mentioned in my report, declined to comment, and a lot of them kind of said that it was because they were told not to comment by the president of their chapter or whoever it was. And I know you have your own experience in Greek life, not at UBC, but I was hoping maybe you could kind of talk about your own experience and maybe speculate why there's a bit of control when it comes to talking about this situation, which is obviously very sensitive and there's an investigation underway, and obviously that factors into it. But yeah, I kind of wanted to hear your thoughts as a former fraternity member.
Yes, I, in fact, was a fraternity member at the University of Tennessee in the United States. Fraternities in the South, which is where the University of Tennessee is, the southern area of the United States. Greek life is very big there and very closed doors. Not most of the time the university doesn't really know what's going on. And sometimes, like, when things come up in the news or things are mentioned, a lot of times there will be more like an emergency meeting to say, where everyone gets together and basically a script is written out for what people should say. Overall, though, it's mostly just, you know, don't say anything if, you know, something did happen, and, you know, if the university asks you and they question you, then if you don't have 100% don't know, don't just say you don't know. And it's just people will try to, they'll, leadership will try to tell you to be more quiet in a sense and just say you don't know and move along, kind of thing, which I can't say is happening here necessarily. I don't know. But it seems very similar to what has happened in the past when I've been part of the Greek system.
Yeah, and whether or not these allegations are true, I think they are concerning, and I think that they deserve to be taken seriously. And that's kind of why I wanted to pursue this piece further past last week's headline, because I don't want to see it get swept under the rug, like I have seen some other things in the past at UBC. Yeah. Thanks for sharing your perspective.
Yes, I just, like, I also thank you for, you know, allowing me to speak and everything. I just want, you know, the people out there, the, you know, women involved in everything, just, you know, to know that people do care and that, you know, this is a big thing and it shouldn't, like, these people involved should be the last, and hopefully with what happens with what AMS is doing, and hopefully the university will, you know, be more involved, or will say, or will comment soon. And after this meeting with AMS, they will reach out to news, to us or to other news stations, and just, you know, be transparent about what's going on, and hopefully that these girls will be the last that we have to hear about it.
Yeah, thanks, Zach. It was really interesting to hear your perspective as a former frat member on this kind of issue. So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Democracy Watch, CRTR 101.9 FM. And stay tuned for more local content.
Indie rockers Ra Ra Riot play the Biltmore Cabaret on November 2nd. Tickets are on sale now at eventbrite.ca and Red Cat Records, presented by MRG Concerts, CITR Radio, and Discorder Magazine. Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
Independent pop duo Mating Rituals will be bringing their dance rock sound to the Biltmore Cabaret on October 18th with On and Glass Forest. I put you up in a Cadillac. Get your tickets now at mrgconcerts.com or Red Cat Records.
Welcome back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Are you over the age of 18? Are you a Canadian citizen thinking about exercising your right to vote? Is this your first time voting out of province? Never fear, Democracy Watch has your back. Here are four ways to vote. You can, of course, vote on Election Day at your assigned polling station on Monday, October 21st. Polls will be open for 12 hours, and you do not need to register beforehand. Just bring an ID with your name, photo, and current address, or two secondary IDs with at least one that has your current address. You can find your assigned polling station on your voter information card or at elections.ca. And if you can't make it on the 21st, you can vote at any Elections Canada office any day of the week before Tuesday, October 15th, 6 p.m. You will vote using the special ballot process. Again, you will need to bring ID. Advanced polling days, you can also bring your ID and vote at your assigned advanced polling station from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. on the 11th of October to the 14th of October. Last but not least, you can also vote by mail. Apply online or at any Elections Canada office before Tuesday, October 15th, 6 p.m. The special ballot process will be used and you will receive a voting package in the mail telling you your next steps.
All right, thanks, Isa. Get out there and vote, everyone. It is the most important thing you can do. I don't even care who you vote for, pretty much. But yeah, heed that advice and figure out your voting situation and go get it done. So we have heard about UBC's fraternities today and the ongoing allegations. And we're now going to turn to a much lighter piece. This has aired before, but because the 50th anniversary of Vancouver's Bloedel Conservatory is in December, but it is this year as well. It opened in 1969. The anniversary celebrations have already begun. So we're going to play a piece to celebrate this lovely tropical triodetic dome. For those who don't know, the Bloedel Conservatory is, as I mentioned, a triodetic dome. So it's like a glass circle that has three different environments in it. There's a desert, a tropical environment, and one others. But it's altogether, it's quite a tropical experience. There's a lot of birds, parrots, cockatoos, a ton of different types of birds. I don't know anything about birds, but there's just a huge amount in there from all over the world. There's also a great diversity of plant life, and it is really kind of an otherworldly experience. And so we're glad it exists. And so we're going to take a listen to this piece that I edited together a few months ago. It's called Charlie and Lena, and it's about a woman who used to work at Bloedel as a gardener, and she would help take care of the parrots, and a bird that she sort of fell in love with named Charlie. So let's take a listen.
I had birds as pets. I had birds on my shoulder most of the time as a little girl. You know, parrots and macaws. But I grew up inland, and we had rivers and creeks, and so we had lush environments. We have bromeliads growing on the trees, and it was just a very tropical environment. I come from the state of Oaxaca, which is on the Pacific coast. And my hometown is a fishing village called Puerto Escondido. It's quite known nowadays. And I always wanted to be a gardener because I grew up growing stuff. Everything that we ate, we grew. My grandfather and I grew. And so it became a passion for me since very early in my childhood. And when I came to Canada, I pursued that dream. My name is Lina, Lina Salina for short. And my connection with Bloedel is that I worked there for about 5 years or so. I started in 2000, and then I stayed there for perhaps 5 years, and then I went for one more year outside in the public park.
What was the title of your job?
Well, my title was a laborer, but I was doing duties as a gardener because I was training apprentices that came through the Bloedel Conservatory.
And so you took care of the plants and the birds?
Yeah, take care of the plants, replant them. The gardener would come and design them, or I would sometimes design them myself. So I was willing and very happy to do a bit of everything. I was just happy to be there. I'm just happy to work there. So it was a wonderful experience to have a personal connection and bond with the birds. One of them was Charlie, rest in peace, dear Charlie. He was such a sweet cockatoo. He was very loving.
Could you describe what Charlie looked like?
He was a cockatoo from, I believe, from New Zealand, Australian. He was white with a tinge of like salmon, and he had like an orange crest. When he got either excited or afraid or showing any emotions, he would end those crests. They're like very fine. When they stand, you can see the bright, bright salmon color. He was the good size, like the size of a macaw, but shorter tail. Black, dark black eyes. Yeah, beautiful. He was just very beautiful.
And you said he would sing and dance. Like, what would he say?
Charlie would mostly mumble, and he just tries to imitate. But the words that he would say, like, clearly would say, like, Hi, Charlie.
How are you, Charlie?
Those he would say clearly. Charlie has this personality where he just makes you laugh, you know? And he would make people laugh, all the kids that would come. Charlie would just stay there still, and you think he's just not going to do anything, and then suddenly he starts talking and dancing and making all these kinds of sounds, and people would laugh, and he would laugh too, and then people start laughing because he's laughing, and it was such comical. He was so comical. He sometimes, you know, would have temper tantrums if something wasn't right. He would, like, suddenly bite. They have feelings. They communicate. They tell you when something is wrong. Charlie, for example, he was possessive. He was jealous if another bird would come close to me in particular, because he became very attached to me. So if he was on your shoulder or on your arm, he doesn't want competition. He just wants all the attention to himself. And he liked to cuddle, so we would cuddle. I would cuddle him against my chest, and he would just loved it. But he was temperamental sometimes, and this is why not everyone held him. Yeah, unfortunately, you know, I had to take care of personal things, and I was heartbroken when I came back from Mexico and I heard that Charlie had passed away. Mm. It was really heartbroken, yeah.
What year did he die?
Sometime between 2006 and 2009. You know, they live a long time. These types of birds, macaws and cockatoos, they can live for a long, long time, you know, 80 years or so. And so they have a lifetime of knowing different kinds of people, and I can only imagine, I'm not an expert, but I can only imagine they get to know people, and they get to spend a lot of time with different kinds of people, and they become attached to these people that care for them, and then suddenly these people leave, you know?
Yeah, one of the volunteers I was speaking with said that parrots often, they often are looking for homes. There's often parrots Absolutely. That need to be adopted.
Yeah, and I think that's wonderful that Bloedel, it's a refuge, not only for people who want to go and have a wonderful time, but also for birds. A lot of people came there to escape the rain. A lot of people came there to take pictures. We are not just hang out. Bloedel, I think it's a refuge for many, many people in Vancouver when we need a little break or just want to go to a different, you know, like the tropics. You don't have to go so far. Just go to Bloedel.
Yeah, it's like its own little world, right?
Exactly. Yeah, it is such a unique place. It was like coming home every day. I went to work. It was just wonderful to have the birds there and the beautiful plants and the humidity level. And, you know, it was just everything was wonderful. But I still go and visit there and visit the birds and see the flowers. And nice to see some more changes. And it's nice to see that some of the old trees, like palm trees, are still there, and it's just more beautiful each time I visit it. It's more beautiful. I hope that Bloedel will stay open forever.
Yeah. So do I.
Off to the highest point of land in Vancouver, Queen Elizabeth Park and the Bloedel Conservatory. This unique 140-foot cryodetic dome is dedicated to a better appreciation and understanding of the world of plants. To appreciate this world of plants, one should be prepared to take a leisurely stroll. Within the controlled atmosphere, one is spirited into the world of the tropics. Here is a simulated desert, rainforest, and tropical climate conditions, and close to 400 varieties of exotic plants and flowers thrive.
Thanks for listening. This piece was made by me, Alex DeBoer. The songs you heard were Blue Hearts 1 and Maha Bone, off the album Blue Hearts in Exile by Gal Grayson. Additional sounds by Alexander Kim. Special thanks to Lena Salinas and the News Collective at CITR.
Thanks to the long-term support of the Rickshaw Theater, Discorder lives. Favorite bands are playing at the Rickshaw Theater. Check out their calendar just behind the cover of Discorder magazine or at rickshawtheater.com. Discorder.
Do you want to voice this one?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Do you want me to voice it? I can
voice
it.
Yeah, please voice
That's
this
the
one.
Wrong mic.
I forgot.
You f dip. I can't believe I put up with this. And I asked for a grape soda, you asshole. Okay.
Due to a labor dispute, CITR is missing its star voice actors. That means if you're interested in producing PSAs, advertisements, and various other promotional wonders for airplay on the radio, we need you. Learn how to get involved with CITR's production department and all other facets of volunteering at CITR and Discorder Magazine at CITR.ca. Programming, photography, media training, and more. Plus, you get a star in the lounge. Nope.
Hey guys, please vote in this federal election. Pretty please? Please? Actually, no. You know what? F*** this. I'm not gonna beg you. Get the f*** out there and vote. This is your right and your responsibility.
Don't give me that political apathy bullshit.
What's the point?
We're in a climate crisis, an opioid crisis, and a housing crisis. Your vote can actually do something about those things. We know the system is messed up, so let's fix it. Start by voting. Election Day is October 21st. To register, find early voting dates, and any other info, please, please visit elections.ca. And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard a piece on the Bloedel Conservatory, which is turning 50 this year. It's a rebroadcast. So hope you enjoyed that little experimental treat. We have about 10 minutes left in the show. And we were pursuing a couple stories this week that didn't turn out. So we're just going to have some conversation, some roundtable discussion, since there are many of us in the studio today, on a few news issues, both local and national. First, I wanted to just do a bit of a recap on the first English language leaders debate that happened on Monday. I'm sure people have heard some recaps, but this one will be different because we're different people and a lot of you guys are young students, so it's still interesting and relevant.
And part of it was shot like 10 meters from where we are now.
That's so true. I walked into a shot, I think, at one point. Like, they were filming, and I was like, what? And, like, anyway, so, yeah, they were filming in the UBC Nest, which is, like, the new sub-building where CITR is located. I watched, like, half of it there. Armand, you were in the crowd, too, watching?
Yeah.
It was broadcast on some TVs. What were your first what takeaways did you have, Armand?
I think most people found it a lot of candidates. I think it's been covered a lot. And just the kind of format of the debate. But I think on the whole, I was expecting a lot worse because they did something interesting where they allowed people to ask, you know, you could ask another candidate one question.
Yeah.
And I found those interesting and they were often entertaining as well when like Scheer immediately turned to Trudeau.
Yeah, I remember that.
So I think there were a few things that were that they tried with like six candidates, I think, that didn't work out so well. And there are other things they tried that worked out all right. So just in terms of the format, I think it was better than I expected because I was expecting it to be a lot worse with six candidates.
Well, I mean, like, I'm sorry, why was the Bloc involved? Like, I just, that actually makes me mad because it's a waste of time for, you know, all of Canada, even in Quebec. We're talking about a country that's going to lead or a political party that's going to lead the country and form government. And there's no way that the Bloc will be part of that. I mean, yeah, they're going to get some seats in Quebec, but like it's a huge waste of time and a distraction from like actual issues, though. I'm not saying Quebec separatism isn't an issue, but yeah. And also the PPC, like, again, I mean, I guess Bernier could prove that he had a chance of winning enough seats that they had to let him in or whatever, but also kind of a waste of time, in my opinion. Garmon, did you have any takeaways?
Oh, man. Just to go off Armand's point, I thought that the whole debate format was actually pretty wild, in my opinion. Yeah. I'm not sure if the whole asking questions thing was really that good an idea. It just seemed like an opportunity for mudslinging more than anything.
Well, that's what a debate is, right?
Well, there were, I would say also, I would generally agree with that. Like, people, I feel like, took the opportunity to just state, like, their platform and kind of, at the end, be like, anyway, like,
how could you be such a terrible
person? And in conclusion, why do you suck so much?
But at least what I appreciate about that, at least it was with two people.
Yeah.
At least it was a discussion with two people rather than like, you know, four people trying to shout at the same time or six people, which is what the rest of the debate was.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree that, yeah, they didn't actually ask genuine policy questions of the other candidates. Another thing on what you were saying in terms of like the Bloc, it's also the way the whole discussion around Bill 21, it seemed like all the politicians were trying to skirt around the issue and not actually like offend anybody in Quebec, but at the same time, like confuse people enough in the rest of Canada so that, you know, people don't get upset about it.
That's politics.
Yeah, it was really just frustrating to watch. I think just because I don't think people in, at least in urban areas in Vancouver, are super concerned that we want to stop, you know, like
totally.
But oh no, there are too many people who wear different types of hats in our government. I don't know, working as teachers, and we need to like have laws against that.
Yeah, it's a very regional issue being discussed on a national stage. But there's a lot of votes in Quebec. And yeah, I mean, I thought that it was interesting how much space that topic took up. It was so funny that Trudeau now has his stances that his government might be willing to intervene. He's the only one that would consider maybe intervening.
Yeah, that's a strong position.
And he's like, then why don't you commit to maybe intervening, Jagmeet Singh? And it's like, and it's clearly because his cabinet has told him not to say that. Yeah. Like Jagmeet's like points like at his turban and his beard and is like, I clearly am against it. My whole life is fighting that bill every day, he said. Yeah. But I thought like Trudeau's wishy-washy stance was pretty funny. I mean,
he had the strongest position, though, right?
Yes.
Formerly, the strongest position of any candidate was that in the future I may consider intervening.
Yes. Yes. Absolutely correct. It's funny. Yeah. I'm interested, though, too, in like whether you guys, anyone here, thinks that the debates really make a difference in swaying voters' minds. Because I personally know who I'm going to vote for already. Well, I have voted. I did early voting. I don't think that the debates make a difference for me. But what is your take on that?
Yeah, I would personally prefer more like long form debates where I can actually like understand a political party's platform. I think we hear a lot of like stories in the news about certain scandals and what's like bothering a candidate. Mm-hmm. But we never hear about what a candidate stands for. And if we had just had like longer conversations about political issues instead of like the same like mudslinging that we've seen like throughout all the scandals we've seen so far.
Yeah.
Like we already know all this stuff, and the debate was more just a reminder of everything that's wrong with the candidates instead of like what the party stands for as a whole. Because like if you were trying to like ask me what's different between the Liberals and the NDP, I might be able to list a few like differences, but like the average person may not be able to like really understand what's going on there.
Yeah, what do you think, Armand?
Yeah, I think there are a few people. I think the clips are the big ones. Like, I don't think a lot of like swing voters, actually like who don't follow politics that much, I don't think they necessarily watch the whole debate. I think a lot of those types of people, they just like might see a few clips here and there, and I think oftentimes when you watch things in the context of the debate, like I remember the opening of Andrew Scheer, he made some like he took a question. And he turned it into like questioning Justin Trudeau's like how could you fire those women and all those things, and that seemed kind of very out of context in the form of the debate. But you know, it's very kind of effective when it's like clipped later, and even like other moments when there's discussion about abortion, where I remember Elizabeth May. Had a very good moment, and that might have been appropriate even in the context, but also just like as a clippable moment.
That's a really good point that like even when they're preparing for this debate, they're thinking not only about how will I win this debate, but how will I create audio clips and visual clips that can be cut out and put in news stories.
Yeah.
And you see that too in the way the candidates would turn to face the camera at times. They're talking to you. They're thinking about not am I going to win this debate, but like how will I speak to people directly, voters directly, and how will this image be used later?
Yeah, it seems like there's an obsession these days when it comes to like sound bites. And it's been something that's been progressively getting worse over the past, I'd say, 20 years. And like, I think that's more just the onus is on like us to like really seek out more of this like long form conversation about what's going on. I mean, we can always ask for like more long form debates, but until like us as a society like drifts away from this sort of like 6 second sound bite, like, we won't really get that.
I have a question. What do you think of having more debate? Do you think that would be more helpful or just, like, more sound bites and not helpful? Because it's only, like, one English language debate.
Isn't there one more?
No. It's just the one. There's a French one tonight.
I think there's one more. Armand and I disagree.
Yeah.
Okay, you're probably right.
But like, well, just in general, do you think?
Yeah, there's not a lot.
Do you think there should be more?
I think that there should be more. Like, okay, I mean, I think part of the reason I like municipal or civic politics so much is because it's the closest we have to direct democracy, where we have citizens going and speaking to council, to their elected officials, and having council listen to them, hear their concerns, ask questions. We don't have enough of that in provincial or federal politics. There's very little opportunity to really hold your politicians to account. And of course, that is by the nature of those levels of government too, because you're further and further from the actual area and people you're representing, because you go to Victoria or you're in Ottawa or wherever, and you kind of like get more removed from the neighborhoods and the people you're representing, I think. So I think if there were more debates or rather maybe not so much debates, but question and answer kind of public speaking opportunities between publicly elected officials
like
and their
halls?
Constituents, like town halls. Yeah. Yeah, I think that would be helpful for me. Definitely.
Yeah. And
I don't know.
What do you think?
Yeah, I love the whole like town hall event style. I think we only see that more in the U.S. And like, honestly, that's what I've been like.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like I watch all those like CNN town halls all the time. They're so interesting. Like you actually get to like understand like what a person stands for. And we don't really see that a lot in Canadian politics. Which really I found weird, like, to be honest. Like, do we have like town halls for all the major kinds?
Well, there was this.
There have been. Or go ahead, Armand.
Well, there was this CBC kind of series where they had like face to face, which was kind of even like was quite interesting because they had like different citizens in Canada just like literally sit in a seat in front of a candidate for 5 minutes,
right?
And ask them questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had like three or four of those citizens over the course of an hour, and then like the moderator would come in after the citizen had done and just mm-hmm. like ask a few more follow-up questions.
When was this?
I think it was just like the last couple of weeks.
Oh, okay.
I saw it online. Like it's on like the CBC Gem app, and that I think that okay. was some very similar. It was quite different to a town hall in the sense that there was a lot of focus on like an individual telling their story, like their complete story of their life situation
mm-hmm.
and what they're looking for in a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
As against, I think oftentimes you see in a town hall is just like a single question, like, oh, so and so is a student, and this is my question.
Yeah.
I think that from the debate too, I'm really struck by, and like we were just talking about, you know, Bill 21, and how, which is the bill, for those who don't know, which in Quebec that prevents public, like people who work in public spheres from wearing religious, outward religious symbols, like wearing a turban or a hijab or a kippah or whatever. So anyway, like in the debate, all the leaders are like, well, I don't know. They're like, they don't want to condemn it outright because they'll lose voters because it's quite popular in Quebec. Like over 60% of people are in favor of it. I don't know. It strikes me sometimes how it's like, does democracy work? Is it working where we're making these compromises to get votes constantly? Like we're always, it's a kind of idea that I have explored in pieces I've done over the last year where it's like, is the middle where we come together or is it where we lose ourselves? You know, like we're here. Okay, well, you're a bit racist, so I'm going to meet you here because this is democracy. Or, like, you know, things like voting on, like, basic human rights. Like, that happens not so much in Canada, but, like, votes happen all the time. Like, there was a vote in Ireland recently on, like, abortion. Like, things that are, like, we don't have to talk about abortion, but, like, or, like, gay marriage. But stuff that, like, most people would consider human rights. And it's, like, why are we voting on this? But at the same time, that's democracy, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Sometimes I just feel like the differences between the parties are very little. And it's all really just sort of about power more than it is about, making the country better.
That's a very sad note to
Wait, do you guys have thoughts? That doesn't have to be the final thought. Anyone have something better to say?
It's only going to be more pessimistic for me, okay. So I'll probably not talk about
it. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, there's, you know, the actual doing of politics can be very messy, but I think mm-hmm. when you look back over like a long period of time, you can sometimes see progress in terms of like, you know, trends. Like,
that's true, Armand.
Like, for example, like the fact that there's somebody of color who's running for the first time in a major party.
Yes.
Like, you wouldn't have thought about that, you know, like 50 years ago or something. So
it's true, though the other four leaders were white men plus one woman who was white. But you're right. You're right. that is nice to think about. Yeah. So that's our show for today. But please vote. I was going to say something else. I can't remember. Please vote. Elections are on October 21st, as you heard from News Collective member Isa, comrade Isa. You can go to elections. What is it?
Elections.ca.
Elections.ca and find out more info. Do some early voting if it's still open.
It is,
which
until
we learned. Until the 15th.
Who here has voted?
I have. Nice. High five.
I'm 17.
Okay, we've got some Americans and we've got some 17-year-olds. And I haven't voted yet.
Yeah, I'm waiting last minute.
I'm voting last minute too. Okay, let's see. Okay, and
thank you for listening to Democracy Watch. We're here every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM. Tune in for local news coverage and. Yeah, I think that's all I have to say. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more CITR programming.